into it when all the shouting started. He turned around once I was seated inside the car. The older policeman from the street rushed into the store and grabbed the younger one from behind. It took all three of them, the two store guards and the older policeman, to force the young one out of the store and back onto the sidewalk. And Malik? He went up to them and started speaking with them. The young policeman was very angry by now. He shouted at Vasily and pointed into the store. She stopped, her eyes focused on the scene in her memory. Then, Lucita resumed, Vasily lifted one finger as if he was trying to catch the attention of a waiter in a very fine restaurant. Three very big men in dark coats suddenly appeared, just as if they had risen out of the sidewalk. They took the young policeman away with them. It was a special store, Dan realized, reserved for foreign shoppers and upper-echelon Communist Party members. Not quite, Lucita said. It was reserved for high government officials. Not even foreigners were allowed into it unless they were the guests of an official. And no ordinary citizens could get in, Dan said. No. From what Vasily said, the young policeman suffered a nervous breakdown. I'll bet. If he didn't have one then, he certainly had it by now. He's probably sitting in a mental hospital somewhere, juiced to his eyeballs with the latest brain benders. A small shudder went through Lucita. I will never return to Russia. Not willingly, at least. Dan's eyes widened. So she understands that she can be forced to do things she doesn't want to do. She's grown up enough to get that through her skull. Malik's helped her to become a little more adult in his own way. Let me fill your glass, he said. Thank you, but no, I must go. The shuttle leaves in half an hour, and I must be on it. Going back to Caracas. Yes, she smiled wanly. My tour of the world is finished. Now I must get back to reality. Lucita got to her feet and Dan stood up beside her. She looked small and fragile, and very vulnerable. He wanted to take her tiny hands in his and keep her with him. But he knew that he could not. There were too many other things he had to do. She would be in the way, and she could get hurt. Her dark waif's eyes were looking up at him, searching, hoping, expecting. I'll see you off at the shuttle, Doc, he said. The light in her eyes faded. She stepped slightly away from him. No, she replied, that will not be necessary. But I... Please, I have made it this far alone. I can find the shuttle without your assistance. Something in the way she said alone made Dan ask, And your aunt? Your duenna, how is she? Teresa? Lucita's beautiful face became as cold and distant as the moon. Teresa committed suicide a week ago. We were aboard the Soviet space station when it happened. Kosmograd, they call it. Suicide? Dan felt it like a blow to his stomach. How? What happened? But Lucita shook her head and went to the door. I don't want to talk about it now. I am bringing her body back to Caracas with me. Goodbye. She almost ran to the door, leaving Dan standing alone in the middle of the small room. He wanted to go after her, to bring her back and keep her with him. But he shook his head and told himself it wouldn't be wise. You're on your way to the States, old boy, he muttered to himself. The last thing in the world you need is her tagging along with you. 2 days later, Dan arrived at New Orleans International Airport amid the pushing, yammering, frenetic influx of tourists who were thronging into the city for its annual Mardi Gras celebration. It was utter foolishness to return to the States, Dan told himself. Pete Weston had argued adamantly against it. The few staff people he had informed had all been stunned at his decision to do it. Dan himself knew it was risky at best and more than likely to be a totally useless and even dangerous move. But as he dug his exquisitely forged passport out of his shoulder bag, Dan was beaming inwardly. The airport was teeming with arriving tourists, roaring with the noise of jet engines and thousands of human voices. Dan smelled perspiration and perfume and the harsh scent of the powerful disinfectants the cleaning crews used as he jostled his way slowly through the long, sweaty, impatient line that had piled up at the immigration barrier. The airport was not air-conditioned, despite the heat of the crowd. Air-conditioning was a luxury reserved for the summer, and even then only if the electricity rationing board permitted it. The customs officer's cheap-looking uniform was stained through with perspiration. He looked about 50, bald, bored, irritable. Barely glancing at the passport, he asked Dan, "Where's your place of residence, Mr. McKinley?" "Minneapolis." "Just coming back from vacation," Dan lied. "Been to see Havana. Terrific town. Just terrific. You ought to see what they've been able to do since Castro died." The man nodded glumly and handed the passport back to Dan. He stepped past the booth, overnight bag slung over one shoulder, garment bag in the other hand, and stood for a moment to get his bearings. Someone bumped into him from behind. "Hey, move it, will ya?" Dan laughed and got out of the man's way. He hadn't heard an angry, impatient bleat like that in years. He was home again. The President of the United States was scheduled to make a speech in the New Orleans Civic Auditorium that evening. Rumors were that she had more bad news to break. This time, it was the expected drop in prices for American grain and livestock. On the commercial airliner from Havana, where Dan had flown by charter jet from Caracas, he had overheard grumbling conversations among the American tourists on their way home, complaining that their dollars bought practically nothing, that the best hotels and best restaurants were filled with Russians and East Europeans, that Jane Scanwell had gotten into the White House on a fluke, and she will never win an election in her own right. For years, Dan had seen reports on all these matters and many more every morning in his daily session with the computer that digested all the intelligence reports his corporate hirelings gathered for him. But to hear the people themselves griping, to feel the intensity of their complaints, to touch the reality of it with his own hands, that was far different from reading neatly typed impersonal reports on a computer screen. He took the airport bus into the city. On this trip, he was moving with the people, no longer the wealthy industrialist who traveled by limo and private jet. He was an ordinary guy, again, taking the cheapest means of transportation available. Just one common man in the midst of a sea of common folk. They were his disguise and his protection, and his source of information. Dan listened to their conversations as the bus lumbered toward downtown New Orleans. Most of the homeward-bound Americans had either gone on to other flights at the airport or taken some other mode of ground transportation. This bus, heading for the major tourist hotels in and around the Vieux Carré, was filled mostly with European and South American visitors, chatting in Spanish, German, French, Russian, and other Slavic languages, and of course the inevitable Japanese. "You must be very careful of drinking the water," a Russian voice said in the seat behind Dan. "I have no intention of drinking water," said his companion, a bored-sounding woman. "No, seriously, they have such toxic wastes here that even bottled water can be dangerous. Who cares? It's the air that I'm worried about. Not as bad as the air in Smolensk. Bad enough." Looking out the untinted glass of the bus window, Dan could see the dirty brown haze that hung in the air, the product of burning coal to generate electricity. Without nuclear power and with oil and natural gas prices set higher by Moscow each year, the United States had returned to its most abundant fuel. But the price for using coal was paid by degrading the quality of the air and by the people who died of lung cancer, asthma, and the resurgence of tuberculosis of a new and deadly virulent strain. Dan got off the bus at the downtown transportation terminal. Most of the foreign tourists stayed on, heading for the fancy hotels. The bus terminal was seedy, filthy. It stank of urine and vomit. Panhandlers shuffled around dressed mostly in rags. Bag ladies huddled in every corner. Helmeted police marched through the terminal in pairs, short-snouted shotguns clipped to their thighs, German shepherds walking unleashed between them. They skirted the sleeping or unconscious figures sprawled on the worn, littered tile floor. Poverty, Dan saw, the kind of poverty that once was confined to the worst ghettos of the biggest cities. It was spreading all across the country. "Everett McKinley?" Dan wheeled to see a short, scruffy man with graying hair and a 2-day growth of beard looking at him. Remembering the identification phrase, he said, "Well, I ain't the Pope." The man grinned at him, showing bad teeth. "Okay, you're the one. Let's go." Instead of taking the risk of renting a car that could ultimately be traced to him, Dan had arranged for a local driver. The man, who knew nothing except Dan's alias, the identification phrase, and his destination, took Dan's garment bag and led him through the reeking bus.